Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to Yaron Weitzman about his book, Tanking to the Top, the Philadelphia 76ers, and the Most Audacious Process in the History of Professional Sports. Yaron covers the NBA for Bleacher Report, and this is his first book. Yaron Weitzman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming on. It's great to have you. I wonder if you could start us off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. How far are we going back? No, I was born and grew up in New York, Westchester, which is a kind of a suburb right outside Manhattan, New Rochelle, which some people might know from the news now. I kind of always loved sports. I'll give the cliff notes, right? Always loved sports, you know, you grew up, I'm about 32. How old are you?
I'm 42.
42. So you're a little older. I'm curious what you've like. I find my age, and you might be in the same generation too, if you grew up in the, I'll call it the shadow of Moneyball and the fantasy baseball era, and it's like everyone wanted to be a GM, and you look at sports, you start thinking of sports from like a GM perspective. At least I find that with a lot of my friends, you know.
Right. I'm certainly there with the fantasy aspect. That may be a little late on the Moneyball thing, or
yeah,
just because I am a little older.
Yeah. So I guess like, you know, I always wanted to be a GM, right? That was the dream job when you're 12 or 14. Also, you know, it's also the stereotypical, I'm the Jewish kid who, you know, was half decent, but knows he's not playing. So figures has to figure out some other way. So then I went to NYU and I majored in sports management, actually. But about halfway through, I realized the whole management part, not really for me. The business side, not my thing. The management side, not my thing, not what I enjoyed. So I started writing for the paper and blogging. I don't know, like this was back when like your blogs were like you made your own blog. And I think if I look back, I'd be very scared, but I feel like it'd be a bunch of awful Bill Simmons impersonations, you know, in terms of writing, like writing about like my night out as if anyone else cares, and how that relates to like the 2005 Knicks. So from there I got a job covering local sports. You know, it's a classic thing, high school sports in the local paper, like from girls high school basketball. I was a beat writer, girls cheerleading, which I got yelled at more by moms there than I do for like my NBA coverage. And I'm not even exaggerating. I got accused of bias for writing about, I forget why, but I was accused of favoritism.
Wow.
Yeah, that's good. It's funny. I believe I remember the story. Like, so that there was a, this is completely tangent, but I think it's a funny story. There was a cheerleading meet I covered once, and this was a local paper, and like the paper closed, you know, everything was in and like had to be handed in, done by like 9:45 at night. Right. And the newspaper business wonders why it's not doing well. Right. But, or why it kind of failed. And like the cheerleading meet started, let's say 8:00. So I had to file, and I think meet is the right word. If not, I apologize. But I had to file my story, you know, way before any final results, meaning I had to kind of find a human interest story or something, and I couldn't actually go off the winners or losers. And I wrote like one of the schools, like their bus broke down, and I wrote about that. And I apologize about that. one of the schools broke down, one of the, their bus broke down. And so I wrote about that. I was accused of favoring them because I didn't write about the winners. Anyway, tangent. Yeah. So from there I got an internship at Slam Magazine through like, you know, networking and started pitching everywhere I could. And like one of the first big stories I wrote was about Ray Rice and his connection to New Rochelle. I wrote that for SB Nation long form, and I wrote a couple pieces for the New Yorker and something for ESPN.com and The Ringer. Like I wrote about why Jim Nantz gives away his ties after national championship games. I spoke to him about that. And then my big break essentially was with Bleacher Report was I pitched them a story and did it on a Where Are They Now on Adam Morrison, where I don't know if everyone remembers, but he was the Gonzaga star who was basically a bust in the NBA. Not basically, he was a bust, a number three pick, and he was kind of famous for crying on the court, and he was looked different, you know, this white guy, long hair and mustache, kind of counterculture. And there was news about that. He had like an apocalypse bunker. People were making fun of him about it. And I went out to Spokane and spent 2 days with him. He took me shooting at his private gun range. We played golf. He showed me his bunker. We all laughed then. I think in hindsight, maybe he was ahead of something, you know, ahead of the time there. He might have been onto something. And that story kind of got me in the door at Bleacher Report. It did well. It was a good story. From there, I started covering the Knicks and some NBA. And then I became a quote-unquote national writer. And that sounds more important, but the way I just – it's not that. The way I just explained it is that it's a national audience. So your job is to find stories that resonate with a national audience, NBA, and being in New York with the Knicks and the Nets, that wasn't happening in New York. So I started heading down to Philly a little bit. That was when the team was kind of on the rise, and covered them for a playoff run. And from there kind of thought, oh, this would be a good book idea. And that's sort of where this came about. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that was great. So in the title, you referred to the most audacious process in the history of professional sports. For our listeners who may not know as much about the NBA as you or I, can you please explain what the process is?
Sure. The most simple way I'll do it is, you know, they're essentially going to take advantage of in professional sports. And I always find this funny, right? You have a bunch of free market absolutists like these owners, and yet they're so worried about protecting themselves. And they start to have a, you know, a more socialistic thing where if you're bad, you get, and I'm not, I mean, that in a critical way, but if you're bad, you get more, you get a good draft pick, right? The worst team gets the highest draft pick. The Sixers decided, they would take advantage of that system. We're going to be really bad for a few years with the hope of being great for many years. That would be how I would kind of summarize it. So essentially built a team to lose. The good comparison, if you've seen Major League, the first Major League movie where she builds a team to lose, this is that. Though there was no, there's no cutout of the owner where they were stripping off the pieces to see him naked. But other than that, this is pretty similar.
See, now you're hitting my age demographic. In the
it's an all time like good movie.
Oh yeah. This is kind of a random question, but I know that the Sixers trademarked. Did they trademark the process or trust the process?
Trust them. The Joel Embiid trademarked the process. The Sixers trademarked trust the process.
So was that a factor in you coming up with a title for your book? Was that something you had to worry about?
Yeah. Let's say the title was supposed to be something very different until the last minute when it was made clear that a very tall person would likely, representatives for him would likely take legal action. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. So jumping into it, obviously, a huge character, maybe the most important character in the book, is Sam Hinkie, who was very much the architect of the process. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about his history prior to coming to the 76ers and maybe a little bit about personality? Would give us an idea what kind of guy Sam Hinkie was.
Yeah.
He's still with us.
Still with us. He is, yes. Different, unique in the literal sense, right? Like he's very, like literally unique in terms of one of a kind. So he grew up in a small town, Oklahoma, was a jock there. I don't mean that in personality. I just mean that, you know, he loved sports. He was really good. High school basketball and football. He probably could have walked on Division I level if he wanted to and like gone the assistant coach, you know, maybe become a scout route, you know, hope to work your way up. But he thought differently. And from there, I don't know. He always thought differently. Even like he tells a story. There was quotes from him. I don't even know how to summarize it. Like I could look it up. But I don't even know how to summarize it. Talking about like the first date he had with his now wife and just like the way he processed it. is, you know, talking about Joaquin knew that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her, but he says it in a way, and I wish I had the quotes in front of me, and if someone's actually curious, they can look it up. But he almost sounds like a robot the way he talks about it, where it's like, I did the math, and I noticed that, and he proposed early, and I knew that I wanted to be with her forever, and because of that, I proposed early because, I don't know, I'm not doing it justice, but just a different kind of guy. The other thing important to know about him is that, and this is really sad, obviously, his brother committed suicide. His brother shot himself when Sam was 10 and his brother was 17. And that certainly affected him. So he goes to Oklahoma, goes to college there, then goes to get an MBA from Stanford. And from there, he always wanted to work in sports. And like he in Oklahoma, he was on, you know, all the leadership count committees and every special every special program for students and all that. And he was doing all that. He always wanted to work in sports. He goes to Stanford, gets some internships, maybe with the 49ers first, but then with the Houston Texans, the NFL, reaches out, sends like basically a letter, and it stands out because this guy's a Stanford MBA. And this is when these kind of guys, you know, now every team has 14 of these guys, but this was different back then. So it stood out. Gets a job there. He's worked a lot of work for them in the draft and prepping. Wants to stay on. They don't have a position for him. Sends a letter to the Houston Rockets. His general manager then. Again, the resume stands out. The resume is brought to him. It stands out because a Stanford guy who has NFL experience wants to work. Figured the Houston Rockets, this guy named Carol Dawson, says, oh, it'd be great to have somebody different here, right? We have all former players. Let's bring in a different perspective. Gets in the Houston Rockets, stays there forever. Happens to be that this guy named Daryl Morey gets promoted. He becomes the Rockets chief, president, GM. And he's sort of the closest thing in the NBA to Billy Beane in terms of a pioneer. And even Michael Lewis, right, did a big New York Times Magazine profile of Daryl Morey. I don't know. Or the Rockets and Daryl Morey and Shea Mattier like 10 years ago, maybe even longer. Basically positioning him as the Billy Beane of the NBA. So that's, you know, with him, he rises up, Hinkie rises at his side. From there, the Sixers hire him to sort of execute this plan of tearing the whole thing down. I think that's also a key part is, so he was the architect, but like, you know, if you hire an architect to renovate your house, the architect is also carrying out your vision. Hinkie was carrying out the ownership vision. They were all on board. Ownership in 2011, it was new ownership. It was some private equity guys who came in and basically figured they'd apply private equity principles to the NBA, to running an NBA team.
Right. So obviously this is not the first process in sports, right? I mean, it became known as the process, trust the process. It became controversial around the league. But certainly other teams have tanked in the past and will do so in the future. What made this process unique and why did it become so controversial?
They took it deep further than anyone else, I believe, right? I mean, in other sports, yeah, like the Houston Astros were kind of similar. But they took it further. We've seen teams do it a little bit, but not as egregiously in terms of like not having any veterans really on your team. Willing to go right. This went 3 years before Hinkie was ousted, and it would have gone more probably, right? Or maybe one or two more. That's longer. Usually you see one, maybe two. The other part is Hinkie's personality. There's a bunch of things, right? Hinkie represented the changing of the guard among the NBA, and a lot of people didn't like that. And you see that in baseball too, the whole idea of old school versus new school. Hinkie represented new school. His personality was polarizing. He very much believed in the work, that the work would prove it. And he believed that like in the idea of keeping a competitive advantage and not, you know, not gossiping to media or not gossiping to other teams and just keeping things, not because he thought he was better than people. He just thought it didn't serve him. Everything. It was very, it was zero sum. You know, it was the idea of like everything, every decision is looked through and through the lens of, or is perceived through the lens of, will this help me? Right. There's no, the switch was never turned off. So you combine all that and how he's different and he speaks differently and you see this everywhere, right? And just a lot of people took it as a challenge to the way things normally are.
Gotcha. There's a fascinating story in the book. I found it fascinating about Hinkie. Just within the context of everything that happens and the way things play out, in which he, I think he was talking to Josh Richardson Jason Richardson, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And he said something to the effect of, I need a back door, wherever he was, I need a back door because everybody's going to hate me.
Yeah, and the rest, he was asking for a restaurant. He was asking for a restaurant recommendation.
Okay, right. Yeah. I found that quote just fascinating because it was so, you know, it really foretold what was about to happen or what would happen in a couple of years. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that quote and maybe share with our listeners how you came across that.
Yeah, it's a great quote because it shows he was aware of, like, you know, people wouldn't like him, right? He's basically the background is that he made a big trade in his first draft of the team 2 months in. They trade their best player, Drew Holiday, who's like 23, 24. An all-star, but the assessment was he was signed for 4 more years. He was owed big money. We're not going to win a championship while he's under contract. Let's trade him now because we'll get max value. After that trade, one of the veterans, one of the lone remaining veterans, this guy named Jason Richardson calls and reaches out, you know, wants to have a meeting, see just what the deal is. Like, is there still a place for him in the team? Him and his manager go have a meeting with Hinkie and they talk. At the end, Hinkie, you know, asking for rest amount of recommendations to give him son. And he goes, was there a back door? Because everybody in the city, I'm going to have to sneak out because everybody in the city is going to hate me. So just telling him, he was aware. He just thought, you know, he would say like that they all wanted the same thing. He just knew better than fans how to deliver to them and that, you know, he was sort of saving them from themselves and that the work would speak for itself and that eventually it would all pay off, right? And they'd win and he'd be celebrated. And not in an egotistical way, that he would also deliver them what they wanted. The way I got that story is actually, you know, Jason Richardson's manager talking to her. So the Sixers did not participate in this book. They sort of blocked me wherever they could. So when that happens, you kind of have to go digging deeper. So I spoke to Richardson. He mentioned his manager went with his meeting. So I reached out to her. And I don't know, I just journalistically, I'm like, those are the ones where I pat myself on the back, if I may. Was just like you made a random extra phone call to somebody that no one else would speak to, and you get this great anecdote that just is so telling.
I saw that you, I haven't heard it, but I saw that you did Jeff Perlman's podcast, To Write a Sling and Yang. And I'm a big fan of Perlman's. I've listened to that podcast a number of times. I've read his books. Great guy. I don't know him personally, but seems like a great guy. I've emailed with him a little. And he, one of his favorite lines is always make the extra call.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, authors I've spoken to is, I mean, that's a great example, you know, right? If you think of somebody who might be helpful, call them because you never know what they could have to offer.
For sure. Especially if you're being blocked a little bit, right? You got to kind of don't like, I'd like to think I would still do that if like Embiid and Brett Brown and Sam Hinkie and all these people were giving me 5 hours. I'd like to think I still would, but honestly, I know deadlines are tight, right? It's easier to not to. And so it's a good lesson for myself as well. Yeah.
Yeah, so as you just stated, and you note very early in the book, I think right in the prologue or preface, that the 76ers did not cooperate in this process, in your process. Why do you have an idea why they might have been unwilling to talk?
No, honestly, I don't get, I mean, yeah, why at first it's easy to say no. Like, you know, I don't think they want this book out. I don't mean that like in a conspiratorial way. I think just they just weren't ready for it, right? It's not a story there. Like, it's not a story they want to tell. Like, there's no, I mean, even if, and I get it, right? Like, it's not like, there's no way the book is that they're amazing. And I write it pretty down the middle, but like, they didn't win a championship or anything. So it doesn't fully work. So there's that. It's easier to say no. They said a bunch of people were doing books also. That I found out is both true and not true, right? I think a bunch of people reached out about interest, but like, you know, I would explain as a difference between saying, hey, I want to write a book versus, hey, I have a book deal and the book's coming out on this day, right? So there's that. Part of it is like the whole process thing. They don't love that being part of their history, though. Again, they'll say that, but then trademark trust the process, right? So it's kind of like talking out of both sides of your mouth. Then why? And then, I mean, I don't have, but then why? But why from a PR standpoint, when I say PR, I should always, like, I'm not always clear on this, like the decision is coming above PR, right? Like above the PR staff, they're not the ones making the decision. But why from a public relations standpoint, you know, lowercase p, lowercase r, are you not bringing me in off the record to talk about things or like try to spin me? I don't know. You know, I don't know at all. I don't have a good reason.
Yeah. No, I hear you with that last point, especially why not get, you know, their viewpoint out there. Mm-hmm. But who knows? So probably the biggest reward of the process, and we'll get into later on of whether the process worked or not. Clearly, there were positives and negatives. There were the, you know, Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, and there was Jahlil Okafor and Nerlens Noel and Markel Fultz. I think everyone would agree Embiid was the biggest prize, the biggest reward of this process. And he comes across in the book as kind of a complex character. Everybody knows he's a prodigious talent, but there are some questions about his maturity and his commitment, specifically his diet, which is, you know, quite comical at times, actually. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about Joel Embiid?
He's a different kind of guy, right? He's like both confident and funny and full of personality, but also an introvert. And, you know, he grew up shy. It took him a while to find his skin. He kind of picked up basketball when he was 15, 16, whatever the age was. And, you know, was really good at it and sort of a genius, probably a genius in all terms, right? Basketball genius, but also, you know, like, he's funny in his second language. I always like to use that. Like, that's so hard to do, right? To be funny in a language that you had to pick up. And like, I think it does take a level of genius to do that. He's also, he recognized early on in his Sixers tenure that he was the most powerful person in the organization, right? Because he's a superstar, and superstars are what matter most in the NBA. So sometimes that can lead to issues like him not showing up in shape well. It's showing up in shape, and you know, Brett Brown, I have a story about him telling the medical staff, like, we're all gonna get fired if we don't fix this. Other times it's good, like when, you know, this is after the book, this happened last week, when ownership tries to cut a bunch of salaries, employees' salaries by 20%, and Embiid basically publicly bullies and embarrasses them, and they change it, they go against it, right? They change their decision. That's an example of him using his power for good. Just a really interesting guy. I enjoy him. I enjoy his personality. I think as a basketball fan, you wish you dedicate himself to the craft a little more, meaning being in peak shape and things like that. But just a lot going on. You know, he comes over to the NBA in his rookie year, early in his rookie year. I mean, he missed his first two seasons with a foot injury, or two separate foot injuries. Early in his rookie year, he finds out his brother dies back in Cameroon, like a truck, runaway truck. I don't know what the proper term is. Ran through like into a school playground or something horrible. Now obviously that affects him, right? So you have all these interesting different things that, and that ended up being like a theme in the book, just how all these complex backgrounds, things we don't see, things that happen behind the scenes way before we even got to meet these people, how these affect who these people become and what the people we do see.
And so speaking of Embiid, of course, I assume you've gotten this question many times, but I have to ask it anyway, because it's the question surrounding the Philadelphia 76ers right now and in the foreseeable future, is the relationship between Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, their other superstar, both off the court and on the court from a chemistry standpoint. How would you describe the relationship between those two?
I kind of now describe it. I wish I used this in the book. I feel like it's like the college roommates that, like, you don't like each other necessarily at first, but you're with each other for a while and you grow a healthy respect for each other, right? Even though some things might bother, some of the habits from one another might bother. It starts like on the court, they're both fantastic. They don't fit well on the court. It doesn't mean you can't overcome it, but, you know, there's just no, like, their skill sets clash. So that's my first thing, right? From there, like, they're not best friends. They're both a bit quiet and introverted and both want to be the spotlight and stars. And so again, you could see how there could be issues. They've never had like any fist fights or anything like that. It's more passive aggressive comments, which again, they're both, I guess, they're millennials, right? Like that age, or young, like that's not surprising that that's how they would act. Right.
Sure.
And Embiid, like, I love people sometimes say, what do you mean he's an introvert? He's so funny on Instagram and things like that. And again, I find that very, I'm not going to say millennial behavior, but it's a class. I think that's more typical among people his age than we probably think, right? Like, you can be boisterous on social media, but in person, you can be more introverted and quiet. That's probably pretty common. And that those two things can exist at the same time. It's a great question. Like, what's the future with him? The issue, I mean, we can go deep on basketball, but the roster built around them was sort of there haven't been good decisions made in terms of the roster building around them. And I think that is more of an issue than the two of them sharing the floor.
As you noted, we use the architect analogy that Hinkie was the architect, but he wasn't the owner, right? And of course, there's this guy, Josh Harris, who is the owner. And he was, you know, as you detail in the book, he was very much on board with the process until he wasn't. And Hinkie had some missteps in the draft. I named a few: Noel, Okafor, Fultz. But you allude to some other factors in the book as to why Hinkie eventually departed the Sixers. Can you talk about that for our listeners a little bit? Why Hinkie eventually left the team?
Yeah, there's kind of like a million things. It was, I hate the cliche, but more of like a straw that broke the camel's back thing, right? Like, so there's some draft picks, and you know, the business side of the Sixers were not happy, because I mean, it's not easy to sell a team that stinks. The NBA wasn't happy because, for obvious reasons, right? It looks bad if one of the teams isn't trying. It's sort of pulling the curtain on the whole thing. Other owners weren't happy. They're telling Josh Harris and the league it's not good for business. Agents weren't happy because one of the teams removes itself from the marketplace, and Hinkie was also, you know, insisting he would try to find every loophole possible in terms of the collective bargaining agreement, in terms of how to sign contracts, how to do them, how to treat players and not give full salaries, you know, that like not hit the salary floor, things like that. They had all these different straws, all these different winds swirling, and then the final straw is Jahlil Okafor, the draft pick, is sort of seen drunk on TMZ gets a video of him stumbling around drunk around Boston streets, and from there, and that makes it, you know, that's on, and from there, you know, that becomes it. That becomes the last one, where the league office is calling angry. Josh Harris decides to bring in lawyers to run due depositions to see what's going on, and there was sort of no coming back for Hinkie from that.
Another fascinating character in the book is Markelle Fultz, who, for those that don't know, was the first pick in the 2017 draft. In fact, the Sixers traded up with the Celtics to get that pick, and very quickly became the most perplexing story in all of sports. Can you talk a little bit about Markelle Fultz's struggles and how the Sixers dealt with them?
Yeah, I mean, Markelle Fultz, one of the things to remember about him is that a lot of number one picks are kind of groomed for that. Like Ben Simmons, right? I think he knew when he was like 13 that he was going to be a lottery pick. Markelle Fultz was still playing JV basketball when he was a sophomore. So from the age of 15 to like from sophomore year to about 2.5 years after that, he's the number one pick, right? That's a fast rise for him and his family. So you remember all that's going on. There's some weird stuff with maybe he was changing his shot a little bit. He had a little injury in summer league that maybe then he started shooting again after that, kind of changed some of his muscle memory. But then what's going on behind that is there are all these stresses. Like his mom is sort of, and again, there's some background there. Like his mom was abandoned as a kid. I believe her parents left. She was raised by her grandmother. So you can understand how a reaction to that would be. I'm going to be overprotective of my child, right? But things like putting cameras outside the house so she can hear and see who was coming in and out when Fultz, this is the number one pick, getting upset at the manager, at Fultz's best friend, who's serving as Markelle Fultz's manager, for not handing out flyers properly in the street, because neighbors were giving Markelle Fultz Chick-fil-A sandwiches and she wasn't happy about that. things like that, making him saying, choose me or him, which is not a choice. And while this is going on, his shot is just deteriorating. Like he basically, we've seen this in baseball, but he basically gets a yips for a basketball shot, right? He forgets how to shoot. Shot looks completely different. He can't shoot his elbow. It doesn't work. The whole time he's insisting it's a shoulder injury. Lots of people were and remain dubious about that. Fultz and his camp have insisted that no, it is. It's one of the strangest NBA sagas we've seen really ever.
And he was diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome.
Yeah, he was.
Ultimately. Were the Sixers skeptical about that though?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He went to a bunch of doctors and they finally found one. And then like the way they announced it is, I forget the timeline. Maybe they told him he wasn't playing. I think they pulled him from the team without telling him. I told a reporter before telling the Sixers. And then, the short answer is, yeah, they were certainly dubious about that stuff.
Right. How did Sixers fans feel about the process in Hinkie as it was going on, and now in retrospect, looking back at those years?
I mean, it's hard to summarize an entire fan base, right? But was interesting, it did see there was a breakdown. It's okay. So Hinkie, he developed a really loud, loyal fan base, and the breakdown was there was often a lot of younger fans. A lot of the fans, you know, I mentioned myself as like someone who grew up in the, you know, thinking of things differently, the Moneyball era of fantasy baseball. A lot of people like that. So they're thinking of, they process their fandom through a team building perspective, through the GM perspective, through of like, this is what I would do if I were the GM. And they were happy because this was the best strategy probably. Tanking at least, maybe not the things in the margins, but in a simplistic way, tanking was the smartest strategy for them in terms of we're trying to win a championship. So a lot of young fans weren't that. People grew up reading, you know, not just like the local, not just the Philadelphia Inquirer, but blogs and analytics and stuff like that. You know, they were pro. A lot of older fans and older media types were not. Fans, if you think about it, it's, you know, sometimes people like if you're 50 at a full day of work and you come home and you don't really care the same way, you just want to watch a team every night that's going to compete and entertain you for a little bit, right? And that's different. And that was not happening there. What did happen, what was interesting though, is so there, the young fans, they were, it's a bunch of pro, and then it's almost like a union, right? These two podcast hosts, or these two fans created a podcast, and it became sort of the voice of the Hinkie, of the process fans, of the Hinkie fans. And it was only like, why compared to a union? It's like, you know, they organized, galvanized, and mobilized all these people into one coherent voice, right? And by giving that, you give yourself even more of a voice and make yourself seem louder. And when Hinkie was ousted, they became, it was almost like the martyr, right? Who goes down and like then they rise up out of that. And Hinkie, that even made them louder and angrier. And it's interesting, like they have power, they have influence. They, you know, the Sixers are aware of what this group of people think and what they say. For sure.
Right. Yeah, and of course, you talk about them in the book.
Yep.
You seem to conclude at the end of the book that the process has reached its conclusion. And I would certainly agree with that. I think when you're paying Tobias Harris, what was it, $180 million, and signing Al Horford to a tremendous amount more money, that's kind of the antithesis of the process. So, in your opinion, was the process a success?
Yeah, I say so. I mean, like the math I do is like they didn't matter before. They gave up a few years, three basically, and now they've mattered for three. They've been a contender for three. I think it's been three. This would have been year three, or is year three. You have to assume there's at least two or three more out of this, right? Yeah, no, I would say so. Like, yeah, you want to win a championship and there are some mistakes made. Again, it's not fair to judge Hinkie fully on that. Like, you know, he got pulled off a project halfway through and nine other people are trying to complete it. So again, and he got pulled off partly for his own mistakes. But if I'm going like simplistic, yeah, I think it's a trade-off. Like if you're a Sixers fan, like your team matters. You care. Like you're watching it every night. ESPN's talking about your team all the time. I think it was a success.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I mean, as a Knicks fan, give me the process.
Right, like, exactly.
I don't need Julius Randle and Bobby Portis so we could win five more games. Like, let's bottom out here and get some top draft picks. Do you think Hinkie will ever have another job in the NBA?
No. I just think, yeah, it's like the way I describe it is like two Venn diagrams, like a Venn diagram where the one circle is teams who'd be willing to hire him and absorb whatever pushback would come from that, right? And then the other one is the teams he'd be willing to work for, right? Because he was scarred by, he felt betrayed by how the Sixers sort of ownership pulled the rug out from under him. And he thought that was an ownership group that he could trust, and he saw things in the same way. So he wouldn't work for anyone, just anyone. He doesn't need to. So you take that list, and I don't know, you're down to, I don't even know who, maybe we can name two, three people. Just, you know, it seems very unlikely.
There's a sense throughout the book that player development on and off the court may have been a weakness for those Sixers. Do you think Nerlens Noel, Okafor, Fultz, do you think they may have had more successful careers if they had played for another team initially?
Ooh, that's a good question. Fultz, maybe, though that a lot of that stuff I think was like that was not the Sixers. What the Sixers got not a nice phrase, but damage good, right? Like by the time he came to camp, a lot of the damage had been done. So maybe another team could have fixed it or handled the situation differently or whatever. The other guys, that's a good question. I mean, there are plenty of people who would say, yeah, right, who would say if they had some strong veterans. And like when I mean veterans, like I think people always sometimes think just if you play in the league for 10 years, you're automatically a good leader. And that's not the case. But some legitimate leadership, right? Some legitimate guys who are actually interested in being mentors and leaders. They got some guys like that, played on some teams where you can kind of see some winning habits. Yeah, it's certainly possible, right? It's like the NBA is a lot of, it's a nature versus nurture question, but I do think nurture plays a big role in the NBA for sure.
Yeah, and even if you talk to a lot of NBA players, they'll tell you, they'll tell you the vets that showed them how to be professionals and how to conduct themselves in the league and how to, on and off the court.
For
and
sure.
It's so much more important now than, a generation ago because these kids are coming in the league at 19 and, just have all this fame. And my God, when I think about the things that I was doing at 19, I could have used a veteran with me at college.
For sure.
To rein me in a little bit.
No, exactly. But, exactly. I agree.
One other person I did want to ask you about, and you've mentioned him, is Brett Brown. How did he feel going through the process? I mean, was he on board with the process, and how did he deal with what had to be a frustrating few years?
Yeah, I mean, he knew what he was signing up for, and he was hired because of that, right? Like, and he knew it. Like, he was really optimistic, and he was a good player development guy, they thought. So for sure, I don't think it's one thing to know, it's another thing to live it. I have a story in there, the second year he's there, the Sixers have two lottery picks and they draft Embiid, who's injured and out for the year, and this guy named Dario Saric, who's overseas and will sign for another 2 years. And, Brett Brown, so they have two lottery picks and use him on two players who wouldn't be stepping on foot on the court all season and maybe more. And Brett Brown turns to like an assistant and says, man, what does this mean? Sarcastic or rhetorically, I should say, right? He knows. So yeah, it's one thing to prepare for it, but then living the losses every day and living the idea of, Brett tells a story a lot, player comes in, I say, nice to meet you, you're our starting point guard. So having to deal with that, the revolving door for sure is it's not easy for sure.
I'd imagine that much more so coming from such a stable and successful franchise as the San Antonio Spurs.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yes, exactly.
All right, Yaron. Well, I've taken enough of your time. I'll ask you one final question that I like to ask of all my guests.
Sure.
But first, once again, the name of Yaron's book is Tanking to the Top, the Philadelphia 76ers and the Most Audacious Process in the History of Professional Sports. I highly recommend it. It's an excellent book. And despite the lack of cooperation from the Sixers, it's apparent that it's extremely well-researched. And just Yaron did a great job with it. So check it out.
Thank you.
So my question, Yaron, is what is your all-time favorite sports book?
Ooh, that is a good one. I don't know if I have a good answer. I feel like, listen, there's the breaks of the game and there's classic answers. I change my answers. Oh, here's a random one. Okay, this one's different. I bet you never got this one. I don't know if this is my all-time favorite sports book, but I love this book. The Whore of Akron by Scott Rabb, who used to write for Esquire for years. And it's about LeBron. It's kind of a memoir. It's not a total sports book, but it's about him, and he's a longtime Cleveland fan, and he's a bit crass, and he does, he's not a sports writer, and so in that way it's good. Like, he's writing about the behind the scenes stuff that he sees and making fun of the reporters in ways that usually someone who's in the field wouldn't do. He's hilarious. It's about LeBron's last year in Cleveland. It was supposed to be a book about LeBron delivering a title, ends up being about LeBron leaving. And Scott Rapp, the writer, is a huge fanatic Cleveland sports fan. I love that book. So I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's a bit different and just, I don't know, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I haven't read that. I remember the book. I remember when it came out, but I'll have to check it out. All right, Yaron. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I wish you the best of luck with this book. It's You caught a tough break. Nobody wants their book to come out during a pandemic, but I wish you the best in spite of that.
I appreciate it, Julia. Thank you for having me on and the interest.
Okay. Thanks, Jerome. Bye.